I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Ian Buruma says that seeing deeply weird plays by an experimental Japanese theater group in the Netherlands when he was a young man was so electrifying that he wanted to go and live in Tokyo. He also wanted to escape his safe and dull middle-class world of, quote, garden sprinklers, club ties, bridge parties, and the sound of tennis balls in summer. He applied to film school and set off for Japan in 1975, where he lived until the 1980s. Buruma didn't spend much time in school and was drawn rather to the avant-garde, to underground theater, to carnival acts, to sex shows. A description in the New York Times review of his new memoir, A Tokyo Romance, captures the flavor of his life at this time. And I'm quoting here, in another performance, Buruma stood on stage amid flying pork cutlets, a drag queen, a dog god, and actors fighting over a placenta in a plastic bag. His role was to wear a leather cowboy hat and exclaim on cue, I am the Midnight Cowboy. Ian Buruma is the new editor of the New York Review of Books, is the author of more than a dozen books, including one about his grandparents, Their Promised Land, that we discussed the last time he was on Radio Times. Ian Buruma, nice to have you back with us on the show.
Very good to be back.
So what was it about Japan or even the Japanese that was so tantalizing to you as a young man?
Well, as a young man, I didn't really know very much about Japan, but I was studying Chinese, again, for no profound reason, other than that it seemed exotic and possibly useful, and I liked Chinese food. But China then was, in the early 70s, was still under Mao, and it was like studying the other side of the moon, and you couldn't really go there, and it was rather grim anyway. And then I saw Japanese theater and film, and that seemed so much more attractive that, in a way, I wanted to join the circus and leave town.
Quoting from your book, talking about seeing this theater group for the first time was like squinting through a keyhole of a grotesque peep show full of extraordinary goings-on. I'd never seen anything remotely like it. You were clearly looking for something that you were not finding in your life.
Well, I suppose most young people are.
I was going to say, like a lot of young people.
And a lot of this was, of course, in the air. I saw this at a theater in Amsterdam called the Mikkeri, which drew theater groups from all over the world, including this country. And it was very exciting then. But the Tenjo Sajiki, which is the name of the theater, was particularly extraordinary. And it was led by a rather charismatic figure who was also a poet and a filmmaker, and gathered people, runaways and so on, and young people around him, a bit like Andy Warhol, and they became part of his kind of, as it were, circus.
Did you want to be part of the circus or did you want to observe the circus?
Well, that's a very good question. I suppose I wanted to observe it, and there wasn't much chance of joining it as a member anyway. I've always been more comfortable being an observer, but as the story in the book tells, I did sort of briefly
you
become
did.
A little bit of a participant.
You also say, and again we're talking about you as a young man, that you were often a performer yourself. And I think a lot of young people feel as if, because they're trying to figure things out, that when they're with their family, they're one way, with their friends another way. You had an interesting family that had, I guess, multiple identities, which maybe allowed you to switch. The code switch,
yes.
In a way?
Of course, nowadays, families with multiple identities, even in Europe, are very common. In those days, little less so. It's not so much that you switch from one role to another, which, of course, you do when you switch from between languages. And my mother was from an Anglo-German Jewish family. My father was Dutch Protestant. And so I did have all those identities, I suppose, if that's what you can call them. But it's also, as an observer, it makes you sensitive to the way people behave in different cultural contexts. And this was not traumatic mm-hmm. for me. It enriched my life, I think, and it made me more open to my experiences in Japan.
I mean, clearly you were searching for something, as young people are wont to do. You talked about having affairs with girls, with boys. Were you searching for something about your sexual self?
Yes, I'm sure I was. And some people, whether that's lucky or not, I don't know, but know at a very early age exactly what they want. I was, I think, searching in many different directions. I was also very influenced by the fact that I was very close to my maternal uncle, John Schlesinger, was a movie maker and gay. And his world to me always seemed extremely sort of attractive and sophisticated. And I'm sure that, you know, a certain element of emulation played a role too.
Hence the Midnight Cowboy reference, right?
Yes.
Did that open doors for you in Japan, being the nephew of...
Not so much. I don't think it gave you a sort of unearned glimmer of glamour, if that's the way to put it. But no, the doors were very quick to open for another reason, which was that there were very few young Westerners in Japan at that time who were interested in the things I was, in theater and film and that kind of thing. And it was also just the moment that many Japanese in the arts were reaching out to the outside world. And so they were as curious about me as I was about them, even though I hadn't done anything to earn this. But it made it easier.
I'd love to have you read a section, but first, how good was your Japanese when you were there, when you got there in 1975?
It was very basic. In those days, if you studied Chinese or Sinology, you had to learn basic Japanese. And my girlfriend was Japanese, and I traveled in Japan for 3 months in 74, and traveled around with people who didn't speak any English. Mm-hmm. So at that age, you're like a sponge. You learn quite quickly.
Well, I'd love to have you read, it's actually the very beginning of chapter 2, and you're arriving in Tokyo. It's 1975.
What astonished me about Tokyo on first sight in the fall of 1975 was how much it resembled a Tenjo Sajiki theater set. I assumed that Terayama's spectacles were the madly exaggerated, surreal fantasies of a poet's feverish mind. To be sure, I did not come across ventriloquists in 19th-century French clothes being whipped by leather-clad dominatrices. But there was something theatrical, even hallucinatory, about the cityscape itself, where nothing was understated. Representations of products, places, entertainment, restaurants, fashion, and so on, were everywhere screaming for attention. Chinese characters, which I'd studied so painstakingly at Leiden University, loomed high in plastic or neon over freeways or outside the main railway stations, on banners hanging down from tall office buildings, on painted signs outside movie theaters and nightclubs known as cabarets, promising all manner of diversions that would have been hidden from sight in most Western cities. In Tokyo, it seemed, very little was out of sight.
Sounds very exotic.
It was exciting.
You had a nickname there.
Well, that's the New York Times reviewer's version of it. I didn't have any nickname. My name in Japan, Buruma in Dutch, Buruma in English, sounds like the Japanese pronunciation of the word bloomer. And so people would always slightly stifle their chuckles when they met me for the first time. And there was one well-known dancer called Hijikata who... was being unpleasant, actually, and called me Pants on the one occasion that I met him. But it wasn't my nickname.
Well, it was your nickname there. I did see a little reference on page 117 there. What's so interesting, and I know nothing about Japan, but I think that the stereotype, which you really break, is, and perhaps more back in the 70s than today, is that it was or is a country of rules and tradition, obedience. How true was that, at least, I guess, on the surface?
Well, on the surface, that was very true, even then. But, of course, countries with very strict rules and etiquette and so on, there are always exceptions. And the tighter the rules, the more extreme the exceptions often. It's in that way a little bit like Britain, where people, by and large, are rather conformist, but the eccentrics are very eccentric. And so... the reaction to living in a society with strict rules in Japan could often take rather extreme forms.
Transgressive.
Yes.
In certain kinds of ways.
Absolutely. And like everywhere else, the 60s and 70s in Japan were, at least in the large cities, it was a time of experimentation and rebellion and so on.
You write about the intolerable web of rules and obligations.
For Japanese,
obviously.
And, of course, that quote is from one of my great mentors and one of the figures in the book, an American writer and film critic called Donald Ritchie. And he often said that he loved living in Japan as a foreigner, because as a foreigner he felt he was exempt from those rules and could do anything he liked, and gave him a kind of radical sense of freedom.
In fact, you were told, stay away from Donald Ritchie. What was the concern there?
I have no idea. I still don't know. It was a man I met once and who'd lived in Japan. I think there was some kind of gay jealousy involved. I haven't a clue. But he did say that. And, of course, one of the first people I met in Japan was Donald Ritchie. And he was an important and kindly and wonderful presence in my life until he died.
What did he mean to you?
Well, he was, in a way, to say that he was a father figure would be an exaggeration, because he wasn't sort of patriarchal in any sense. But he was a kind of mentor, and in questions about film, about the arts, about Japan, and so on. So we became great friends, despite our great difference in age.
He says to you, you know, you have to be a romantic to live in Japan. A person who feels complete, who does not question who he is or his place in the world, will dislike it here. And he goes on from there. Do you think there was something about Japan, or something about being a foreigner living in a foreign country, that allows someone that kind of privilege?
I think the latter. But because foreigners, less so now, because Japanese are much more used to Westerners, and you're now supposed to behave properly in a Japanese sense too. But in the early days, especially during the American occupation and not long after, foreigners really did seem to be exempt from all rules. And that allowed you to make yourself up and do whatever, and adopt all kinds of identities, if you like. And that was very attractive, as Donald pointed out, to somebody with a romantic disposition who's never satisfied with the status quo, but always thinks there's something better to be done, either in the future or the past.
Does that describe you as well?
Yes, I suppose so. I didn't feel I was fully formed. I was absolutely open to all kinds of influences, and that's the only way to be if you're going to be a young foreigner in Japan. If you think you know exactly who you are and so on, then it's just irritating living in a society where, you know, people behave often very differently.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Ian Buruma, our guest on Radio Times today. He's written a new book. It's a memoir called A Tokyo Romance, and it's about being a young man living in Japan in the 1970s into the early 80s. And he is the relatively new editor of the New York Review of Books. And you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times if there's anything that you can connect with that we're talking about, being a young person in search of self. I'm Marty Moscowane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me get Carl from Chestnut Hill to join our conversation. And Carl, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I moved to Japan when I was 21. That was in 1984. Huh? And I stayed until 97. And it was funny because I was wondering, I said, you know, no disrespect, I was wondering if you were involved in any theater other than novelty theater. And I was wondering if you were involved in Butoh. And you did mention Kichikata, who was a very strange individual. But did you have any interaction with Kichikata or Katsuo Ono?
Yes.
Carl, thanks. Yeah, go ahead.
Kichikata was, in fact, the one who said pants.
Oh.
he was very grand in his manner and very interesting. And I did meet him. I knew several of his dancers quite well. And I was part of a group called the Daidaku Dakan, which was an off-spin of Hichikata's Butoh. As far as other kinds of theater is concerned, I'm very keen on Bunraku, the puppet theater, and Kabuki too, but I had no personal involvement in that world.
Carl, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's talk about, they're called Roman porno films. And this is, I guess, a sort of uniquely Japanese form of what, pornography?
Yeah, no, I don't know how unique it was, but it was uniquely skillfully put together. The Nikotsu studio that produced Roman Porno, and Roman stands for romance, not for Rome.
Gotcha.
Had always specialized in films about youth and gangs and gangsters and that kind of thing. And the studio system had begun to collapse in the 70s because of television and other things. And they began to specialize in this new genre called Roman Porno, and it's basically soft porn, but very well-made films, and a lot of young filmmakers cut their teeth on doing this. And so they weren't sort of short exploitation movies with sort of bad actors and horrible lighting and so on. They were very well made, and as such, sometimes of interest.
Well, you even say they weren't tainted with this idea of original sin, which, you know, I don't know whether Wetmore Western porno is tainted with that, the idea of being sinful.
Well, I think, you know, because there is that sense that sex somehow is sinful in Western Christian thinking, somehow this is often reflected in porno, and that the feeling is there's something dirty about it, so somehow it shows. Whereas in Japan, there is no sense that sex as such is a sinful form of behavior. There is a lot of social propriety and a lot of rules in how you behave and what you do in a certain time and place and so on. But the idea that sex itself is sinful would be very alien to most Japanese. And so as Roman porno or other forms of porno in Japan, including manga, in a way you could describe it as guilt-free porn.
Oh, interesting. And the audience, both female and male?
I think like everywhere else, the most consumers of this would be male and not female, but not necessarily always. And as an example of what I just said, I mean, it was not rare to see people on the subway, men going to work in the morning, reading sort of hardcore porno comics. There are, and again, like everything else in Japan, the film studios, they all had their own specialization. And women did, especially young women at the time, were drawn to sort of heavily romantic stories of very beautiful young, rather androgynous young men who fell in love with one another. So, you know, David Bowie was a huge star amongst young Japanese women, and Helmut Berger, nobody's heard of him anymore, but in Japan then he was a fantastic star. And it's sort of, I think for young women, it's romantic and vaguely sexual without the threat of real sexuality.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Ian Buruma about living in Japan in the 70s as a young man, and that's what he writes about in his new book called A Tokyo Romance. We're going to take a short break, get back to our conversation. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And if you're just joining us, I'm Marty Moscowen. I'm talking with Ian Buruma. He is the relatively new editor of the New York Review of Books. He's written a bunch of books himself, a number of them about Japan. And his most recent one that we're talking about is called A Tokyo Romance. And it's a memoir about living in Japan in the 1970s as a young man. There's a word, let me scramble around here. There we go, doroksu.
Doroksai.
Doroksai. What does that mean?
It literally means smelling of mud.
And is tradition the right word? I mean, there's let me just look at your book here and I'll do a better job of asking the question, which means the stinking earth, the seedy, the obscene, the debauched, the bloody, the smelly, all that permeated the art scene, not just in photography, but in theater, film, literature, manga, and even graphic arts. What is this and how does it permeate all of that?
Well, again, it's not perhaps uniquely Japanese. At the time, of course, people were experimenting with that kind of thing all over the world. But I think what was going on then, since the 60s, was that in the Japanese artists, painters, writers, and so on, were reacting against not only the rather stultified state of their own tradition, their own classical arts, which had become rather fossilized, like kabuki and so on, but they were also reacting against a century of Japanese trying to mimic European high art, high culture, which was equally stifling. And so there was a movement to go back to, the, as it were, the more primitive layers of what they saw as Japanese-ness. And you could describe that as, or people did, as dorokusai, smelling of the earth, the earthiest aspects of life.
Does that explain your performance on stage with flying pork chops and someone with a placenta around their neck?
Yes, that group, the Jokyo Gekijo, the Situation Theatre, was very much into that kind of thing and very raucous and took bits from popular comics and from scandals in the papers, and but without in any way imitating the style of kabuki, they went back to the original spirit of kabuki. And kabuki had started off as a kind of theatre performed by prostitutes and outcasts and was deliberately wild and provocative and sexy. And so what a lot of theatre groups in the 60s and 70s were doing was reviving that spirit, but in a very modern form.
How did they get you on stage? As you said, you mostly preferred to be on the edges, on the fringes, observing.
Well, I hung out with that group and with the leader of the group, another one of these sort of charismatic theatre gurus called Karajuro. I liked him very much, and I translated one of his plays. And after many drunken evenings, he wrote a new play and put me in. So that's how it happened.
And did you like being on stage?
Yes, I've always liked being on stage. I was never very good and rather prone to, in a moment of panic, to sort of forget my lines. But yeah, it's great fun.
Did you have a lot of lines?
Not that many, but enough for me on one occasion to suddenly freeze.
You do describe, I think at one point, a woman is tossed in the air to your arms, and I guess for that moment you sort of lost
concentration.
Right.
Well, that was a different group. That's when I was involved in the Butoh dance group. And since the modern arts in Japan are not subsidized, they had to find a way to make money. And one of the ways that these avant-garde Butoh dancers made money was to perform in strip clubs and that kind of thing. And again, I was sort of roped in on one occasion to do this, and I did it very inadequately.
Is it fun to write about strip clubs? And what you write is pretty vivid. It's very descriptive. One, I can really see what it is that you're describing.
It is fun because it interested me. And I was never very interested, unlike some other Westerners, in the sort of Asian spirituality and Zen Buddhism and tea ceremonies and that kind of thing, which was more for people who lived in Kyoto rather than Tokyo. And people like me who lived in Tokyo viewed those people with lofty disdain. I don't feel that so much anymore now I'm getting older. But it's precisely the sort of rough side of Japan that I found much more attractive.
Was it a kind of an upstairs, downstairs? I mean, in certain ways you describe going literally underground or going down into a basement or something below the first floor. Is there a kind of upstairs, downstairs quality to all this?
I don't. Well, upstairs, downstairs, in the traditional sense of the phrase, is all about class and the sort of servant class who lived downstairs in the basements and the upper class who were upstairs. This was not so much a matter of class. It was more that you had respectable society, and then you had the underground of rebels. And it was the underground that attracted me much more, and still does.
You were there to go to film school, and you did make a film, which I'd love to have you read your description of the film, about women whose job it is to be elevator operators.
Ah, yes. That was a
Page 91.
That was a documentary film that I made. In the late 1970s, I made a documentary film for Dutch television about the training of young women operating elevators in the department store. There's nothing natural about the behavior of these so-called elevator girls, with their heavily made-up faces, neat uniforms of high-heeled shoes, white gloves, and prim little pillbox hats, their kabuki-like falsetto voices, and perfectly executed bows at stops on every floor. They not only had many hours of training to distort their natural voices, they had machines to teach them the exact 45-degree bow. The effect was uncanny. Human beings trimmed like bonsai trees, as mannered as courtiers at the palace of Louis XIV. The intention behind this artfully contrived image of bound femininity, one would like to think, was wholly innocent. But there was also something disturbingly erotic about it, as though the modern department store with its childlike jingles, marble floors, and tinkling elevator music were injected with a hot dash of sadomasochism.
That's just such a terrific paragraph there, talking about, I think, all that we have been talking about, this sort of underlay of eroticism.
This was, of course, before the big Calvin Klein ads in the United States of sort of soft porn images of men in underpants and so on. Japan then, before it was true in the West, was a very sort of sexualized place in the sense of advertising and entertainment, and it was thrust in your face all the time, which may be one reason why one reads articles in the papers about young Japanese who are no longer interested in sex. I mean, it's there could be a link there. I don't know, but
ODing on all this, you mean?
Possibly, I don't know, but it didn't mean that everybody was having sex all the time. It just meant that for largely commercial reasons, it was constantly thrust in your face. But there's another reason, I think, why even in the 17th and 18th century, there was an awful lot of erotica in Japanese art. And because it was politically and socially always a very tightly controlled society, and political rebellion was very dangerous in pre-modern Japan. And the way to rebel for artists was often in the erotic realm and to push the boundaries of what was respectable in that way. And that's another reason, I think, why there's so much of it in Japanese art and entertainment.
Did you learn more about your erotic self, having lived there?
Yes, I suppose inevitably, but I probably would have wherever I'd lived. But again, I think being thrust on your own as a foreigner in this very unfamiliar or very strange environment leads to introspection. I mean, it forces you to think of yourself, not only in a sexual sense, but in every sense. It forces you to come to terms with your place in the world.
Let me see what Andy looks like. Andy calling us from Ewing, New Jersey, has to say. Andy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Well, good morning, Marty, Mr. Baruma. This is very interesting. I look forward to reading your book. I've become enamored of the NHK television network and their documentary programming. I wondered if your time in Japan has permanently affected your physicality. I'm thinking of the affirmative nod that seems so prevalent. I find myself sort of doing it just from watching television. Thank you.
Thank you, Andy, for calling in. I'm not exactly sure what he's asking.
I think I know what he's asking. Okay. That people in every culture have distinct physical gestures. For example, Chinese and Japanese, when they point at themselves, they don't point at their sort of roughly where their chest is, but they point at their nose. That's one common East Asian gesture. And so I think the question is, did I end up adopting these gestures? And the answer is, when I speak Japanese to Japanese, then the answer is probably yes.
Yeah.
I think if I were to move about like a Japanese when I speak English to people in New York, it would look a little affected.
And you speak, how fluent has your Japanese remained?
Well, I'm married to a Japanese, so I speak it every day. But I have a good ear, and that means that the foreign languages that I supposedly speak, they always sound better than they really are and make a lot of mistakes.
Tell us about the human pump. Fascinating.
Well, one of the things that you still had in those days, I don't know if you still do, but is the Japanese equivalent of what used to be the carnies in the U.S., freak shows and that kind of thing, who would perform around shrines and temples on festival days. And the human pump was an albino man, one of whose tricks was to swallow goldfish of different colors, yellow and orange. And then he'd get the audience to guess which ones he was going to regurgitate.
Wow.
And he always performed splendidly.
In that he would do
he
the
spat
one,
out the right color.
The right color. That's terrific. You left, what, in 1981?
Yes.
And you also write that while you did leave, Japan did not leave you.
Well, partly because I was married to a Japanese.
Right.
I think one's 20s are very formative years. And so inevitably you're always mm-hmm. going to, in some way or another, be shaped by that experience. And so I think that's certainly true of myself. I mean, if you ask me exactly in what way Japan left its mark, I would find it difficult to answer, but
right.
I'm sure it's there.
Do you find that this underground avant-garde, however you want to describe it, that still interests you? You're still drawn to it?
Yeah, probably not with the same enthusiasm as in those days, but then I don't think that the underground is as interesting as it was in those days and, anywhere. I mean, we're living in a rather dark age in many respects, but one of them is that it's not a period of pushing boundaries and breaking rules and experimenting. On the contrary, I think, without getting to that whole discussion, but people in their 20s now are more, in some ways, I think, reacting against my generation by wanting more rules and more strictures and better guides to how to appropriate behavior and so on, whereas we wanted to be inappropriate.
I'm Marty Moscoen. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Well, let me pick up on that because you wrote something recently. I don't know if it's in commentary. It's called Moralism in the Arts. You did, apparently. I don't know if that's what you called it. But you talk, in part, it's about the Me Too movement, but it's also about what are we supposed to think of artists who are bad people, for lack of a better word. But you also say we should not condemn a work of art because the artist's private life behavior. We should also be careful about applying norms of social respectability to artistic expression. Some art is meant to provoke and transgress and push boundaries. People can do things in works of imagination they would never do in life, which is sort of the reverse of I think, what the Me Too movement is about. But nonetheless, do you worry that we're kind of cleaning up our artistic life?
Well, it hasn't quite gone that far, but if it would get to the stage that we could no longer look at Picasso paintings because he mistreated the women in his life, that would be a very sad day. So I do stand by that statement. It was provoked by an article that made the case that we have to look at Woody Allen films now in a completely different way in the light of what we supposedly know about his private behavior. And I went against that rather because I don't think that you can see in his films that he was a child molester, if in fact he ever was. But I think that art is, and this goes back to your questions about rebellion in Japan and so on, right, that art in many ways, the stage, the film screen, is a way in which people can act out things that in daily life you can't. And whether that's for all kinds of reasons of respectability and getting on with people. And so that's why, you know, people murder each other in films and do all kinds of things that normally you wouldn't do. So if you were to demand that people behave entirely appropriately in an artistic product, there wouldn't be very much art left.
Well, I'd love to go on. We're out of time. Ian Baruma, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. And his new book, it's a memoir called A Tokyo Romance, and it's about living in Japan in the 1970s, 1975 to 81, when he was a young man. He is the relatively new editor of the New York Review of Books, and he's also written a bunch of other books as well, including several on Japan. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.